running around like America.
And your first experiences of, you know, airplanes and airports and international travel.
Never been on a plane before. Yeah. And, you know, sort of coming here. And we arrived at the airport and my two masses had come. And my dad had a friend who had moved to England many times.
Yeah.
Many years before, maybe in the 70s or the 60s.
Okay.
And, you know, and he came to pick us up. He had a car and everything. We got in his car and they dropped us off. In Finchley was okay. Where the house was. In fact, they've still got the house. They've still got the same house.
Wow.
My mama lives there now, yeah. Okay. And as soon as we got there, literally my two masses who were there, who knew how everything works in England, my mom wouldn't have had a clue how to navigate all of that.
Mm.
But my masses were there and they put us into school. And we went for 6 weeks between sort of September and mid-October.
Okay.
To a school in Finchley, Moss Hall School. And in that period, my parents arrived. Wow. My father arrived by himself with his brothers and his siblings. And they ended up going to the camp.
Okay.
Which was actually Greenham Common, Newbury Camp, they used to call it.
Okay.
But I found out it was actually the Greenham Common Camp.
Okay.
Because funny enough, sort of not consciously, but I ended up at the Greenham Common Camp last year. And we just sort of decided to do a weekend away, the Ria and I.
Yeah.
And we had gone to Newbury Town. And on the way back, we just decided to drop in there. We sat there for an hour or two, you know, in the gardens there. And it's actually where the Greenham peace protesters were there. But the army barracks was where they housed.
Yeah.
So my dad, and I can't remember who else was with him, possibly my grandfather, and possibly my dad's elder sister and her family, because she had four children as well. They were all there together, possibly.
Okay.
In Greenham, I'm not sure of the details. And the British government had a policy that they would split families up and
right.
put them in different directions.
Okay.
To integrate them into English culture rather than, you know, all arrive at the same place. So they had no choice or stay.
Mm.
And I remember my grandfather, my dad's two siblings, elder siblings, or three of them, they got a house in Stoke-on-Trent.
Right.
In Newcastle up on the Lyme. And my Faiji, who's the eldest one, with her husband and four kids, they went to right near Sunderland,
right.
Peter Lee.
Okay.
And my dad said, look, my wife and kids,
mm.
they're not here with me, but I have them, but they're in Finchley. So he got a house in London.
Okay.
And that house was actually in Euston, in a place called Somerstown.
Okay.
And just 2 weeks ago, I visited Somerstown again.
Right.
And again, there was a little community event there.
Okay.
And I sort of, the building that we were living in was a council block. And this council block was set for demolition.
Right.
So I think the building had been gutted and the crane was going to come with the ball just to knock the building down.
Mm.
And they decided to re-equip these houses for these refugees.
Right.
So I think there were three buildings there, three stories high. And the buildings had no internal doors, the external doors were fitted, there was no bathroom,
mm.
and they just fitted a kitchen sink, and they had, I remember this bath being in the middle of the room, where you could fill it up, and maybe there was a hose connection to pump it into the sink to empty it out or something, I don't know.
Yeah.
But none of us had baths, we didn't know what a bath was, it was
right.
just showers, you know, with running water.
Mm.
So my parents used to go to Euston Station, where they had public baths to have a shower.
Right.
And the three of us used to be bathed in the kitchen sink.
Okay.
Because we were small.
Mm.
And so we lived there, we were supposed to live there for weeks, but we ended up living there for 9 months.
Right.
And in that time, my father went to claim social security, whatever it was, you know, where they went to the office. And he went there 1 week and he came back depressed. And he never told me this, but he was crying.
Right.
And he went there the second week and he came back and he said, I'm not doing this again.
Mm.
I can't put my hand out to anybody.
Mm.
So he had this sense of pride and he said, I'm not going to put my hand out and take a handout. Now, in the building where we were staying, there was a younger chap just with his wife. And he was an Ishanashri. And he was Ghulam Uncle.
Okay.
And Ghulam Uncle in Kampala was working for an international company who had an office here in UK.
Right.
So when he arrived, he got a job with them in London.
Okay.
So after a couple of... my dad knew he was working. So my dad went and said to him, he said, Ghulam, you got any jobs in your office? I need to get a job. I can't do this handout business.
Yeah.
You know, that's just not me.
Yeah.
So he went and asked and he said, yeah, there's a bookkeeper's job. And my dad used to run a big business in Africa. I'll take anything, he said. So this was in... So this company was an importer. Anyway, he went and worked for them for a year. And in that period, we got a council house in Battersea.
Okay.
I remember going to this council house in Battersea. And that's the first time I really experienced racism.
Right.
Because Battersea, you know, and it was like we had this fear while we were living. That where we were living, there were all these people out there to get us. And I grew up with that fear.
Okay.
And I didn't have any experience. But, you know, one day I remember somebody had thrown a box of matches and newspapers through our letterbox saying we're going to burn your house. And I remember that experience very, very clearly.
Right.
And you used to hear these sort of things, you know. Nothing ever happened, but we would be shouted at on the street and, you know, called packies and all sorts of things. And you know, so that is something that stayed with me.
Yeah, to take cycle chains and go to school.
No, I'll come to that. That's something that stayed with me until I was 20.
Wow.
And that experience, because we lived in this council house in Battersea, and the primary school education experience was okay. There was a little bit of bullying in school.
Okay.
But there was sort of still Afro-Caribbean people there.
Right.
And they were bullied as well.
Okay.
Right? So it wasn't just like we were the only ones. But like if you imagine that, I remember this particular road that we were living in called Stewart's Road, BT House, this council estate which has probably 50 blocks in it. And then there was another council estate. There were three council estates in the whole street.
Mm.
Probably there were only two or three Indian families in that whole street. So that's where we sort of grew up. And like, we didn't have a car, so if we wanted to go to the community centre, the Jamaat Khana of, which was here in the UK, which mushroomed because of this Ugandan refugee.
Okay.
Before there was just probably like 5 or 10
right.
families. But suddenly like 50 families or more
right.
would arrive in London.
Okay.
And so the community even mushroomed. We'd be going there at night, on the buses and all that, just didn't feel safe
right.
and comfortable. You didn't feel like you belonged in this country. And I grew up, and you know, when I went to senior school, it was a very, very rough school. And like you'd have, and this was in Tooting, you'd have people that were like, they would threaten you, like for whatever reason. Yeah, it was Ernest Bailey School in Tooting.
Okay.
And there I'd befriended some Jamaican boys
okay.
who ended up being protection from me and my brother.
Right.
Because, you know, there'd be people out to get you, but these Jamaican boys, they had already, their parents had been here and been
so
through this.
So he created it by doing their homework for them.
Okay. I'd help them with their homework and they give me protection.
That seems like a fair exchange.
It's a fair exchange. And they were... Their parents, because they'd come through the Windrush,
right.
they'd already been through this experience. And their parents were probably persecuted. And these youngsters grew up and they were stronger and bigger. And they weren't looking for trouble, but if trouble came their way, they knew how to deal with it. And nobody would, you know, the friends of mine, because I learned how to speak in a Jamaican accent, they say, mess with him first. You want to mess with him? Come mess with me first. Yeah. And that's how they used to say. And that would be it if there was like what we call a skinhead, because
yeah.
that was the sort of generation at that time that were
okay.
deemed to be the National Front movement. They'd all have skinheads,
right.
and they, that's what they were called,
yeah.
skinheads. And this what we have today, the British National Party, they don't have a particular look.
Okay.
But in that 70s, you'd have this skinhead movement. And I remember when I learned very young age, so at the age of 6 or 7, how to walk down a street
right.
and look for danger. And I'd be crossing the road if I thought somebody dodgy was coming my way.
Mm.
Just not to be on the same side of the road as them.
Okay.
On the pavement. So we'd cross over to the other pavement on the opposite side. And I'd be zigzagging as I was going up to the bus stop to catch a bus to go to school.
Mm.
So that was the experience that we came through. And my parents, my dad used to say he would cry often thinking, what is he left behind and where has he come?
Yeah.
And my mom used to say, I need to go shopping. And then she'd go shopping and then she'd come back. And even though she'd have gloves on, her fingers would be frozen.
Right.
Because like you'd be dragging trolleys or carrying bags.
It's cold.
It's cold. And, you know, in Kampala, everything was, we lived in Market Square. So everything was there. And in fact, the home help would go and get the shopping.
Okay.
So the concept of ever going to shop.
A lot of people helping them in Kampala.
Right.
All the household chores and everything.
They would manage everything.
Well, they wouldn't. The my mom would cook and everything.
Yeah.
But the little bits was taken care of.
The errands and the sort of day-to-day stuff.
Yeah, they're going to the shopping and you just say to whoever it was, it says, can you go and get some potatoes?
Yeah.
Or can you go and get this? Can you go and get that? So when they came to this country...
Yeah.
They had to do all of this, and they had to like, you know, they were like, they didn't know what tin food was in Africa.
Okay.
But they were bringing back tins, and tins are heavy if you have to carry them.
Absolutely.
You know.
Yeah.
So like you know, and this sense where you came, like my parents just had to tell me once, make sure you do well at school.
Mm.
We need to, you know, you need to do well, right? And I never, and my siblings, we never thought back. And if I look at today, my kids, and I'm telling them, please do well in school, they're like, yeah, okay, we'll see. You know what I mean? Because everything's comfortable.
Yeah.
Whereas with us, we have this, we need to do... So, you know, we were living in this sort of council house, and even my dad got a job because he couldn't work in this office.
Right.
He wasn't an office guy. He was very much an out and about. So after a year, he got this job as a washing machine repair engineer.
Okay.
And he took that job because it came with a car, a van.
Right.
So he says, I've taken this job. I've got a van. And it was hot point. And he worked that job for 9 years. But what my dad became very good at was just his nature was such that... He would go and repair 9 washing machines or 10 washing machines to do whatever calls he was given.
Right.
And he'd finish by 2 o'clock, whereas his comrade, his compatriot, his English guy would take all day.
Yeah.
And so it worked out well for him, and we got a car, and you know.
No, he had the van.
Yeah, the van.
He converted it into a car because he put a partition in the middle.
That's interesting.
So the kids could sit at the back,
okay.
And he and his wife could sit in the front. And then after, because he's finished, being a business-minded man, he knew, and he was an engineer because he learned engineering in college, right?
Yeah.
So he knew how to repair things, and he repaired the washing machines very well and very fast. And he even took extra jobs.
Sometimes some people would come and say to him, oh, can you do a private job? And he said, no, I'm not allowed to. He said, yeah, but it's for my cousin or whatever. It'd be somebody said, oh, if it's your cousin, yeah, okay, then I can do it.
Yeah.
So he used to get a little bit of side income from that.
Right.
And half a day also would be free, and then he would take the family out on picnics.
Wow.
And that early time, I remember with my dad, he was a very outgoing person, and he would take us... everywhere. We'd go to Brighton, we'd go to... in a van, Southend.
Yeah.
And imagine, the van's only got 2 seats. And then there's this, like, cage which separates the goods at the back.
Yeah.
And so that nothing comes over and what's the word, falls into the driver's side.
Right.
But he may move that cage back, and he got yellow pages, and he put them there, and some cushions on top of it.
Mm.
And we'd sit behind...
Yeah,
and I think in those, on the yellow pages, and in those days, you know, you didn't have this seatbelt rule, you didn't even have to wear a seatbelt in front. I don't think anybody would stop you, or police wouldn't stop you for doing that.
Right.
It was all okay, even here.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was our life. But I remember sort of growing up with this sort of like racism.
Okay.
The need to do well. Living in areas which were not very... you know, I remember living in a house with no heating and being absolutely freezing cold. And all we'd have is in the living room, a gas fire.
Okay.
And okay, we had electric heaters, which we'd have to turn on. But like I remember that being very, very cold. And so that was the aspect of, and my dad said to me, he says, look, you need to do really well in education, because I come from Mombasa. I've got a higher education degree. I've tried to use it here. It doesn't work.
Right.
They don't recognize that. They say, okay, you went to Muslim Institute of Higher Education, MIOME. It's still around there, very famous sort of African institute. But it has no value.
Right.
I mean, we know that because doctors come from India who are working in hospitals.
Yeah.
And they have to go through a bit of a process before they get accepted here.
True.
Into the system here.
Yeah.
So that spurred us on to sort of to do well. So I think that sort of brings our journey from the Africa to the early days of the UK. Mm. And I just want to say one thing, that when I said it wasn't until my 20s, because I grew up in this environment where we were thinking that there are no English people who like us.
Right.
And this is not a country for us. We've ended up here because we had no choice.
Mm.
We were kicked out of our land. So I was very keen to look for a future overseas.
Right.
But it wasn't until I went to university,
mm-hmm.
and I met another, when I was sharing flat with some, sharing a university flat with some other English people.
Right.
And I remember I had this one incident where I had a car at university because my dad had started a business thereafter.
Okay.
And we had a little bit of money, so I had a car, and somebody knocked my car, and my friends, these two friends of mine who were living in the flat, oh, somebody's damaged your car. So they went around the whole university accommodation campus looking for another car with that paint color on it to find out who the culprit was.
Okay.
And they found it.
Right.
And then we you know, they went and cornered the person and says, I think you've smashed into this person's car and driven away.
Right.
Without, you know, owning up to it.
Yeah.
And I thought, my God, these people, they've gone out of their way. And it sort of brought back my faith that they're not all the same. But that was my experience, you know, growing up. You know, like I was 18 and 19 at university. And that's when I sort of said, oh, there is another reality here.
Right.
But having gone through this sort of exodus refugee, living in the council houses and a poor existence, as it were, poorer existence.
Yeah.
You know, I remember going to the sweet shop at break time from school, and I'd have no money in my pocket, and my friends would be buying stuff.
Compared to your memory of going to the sweet shop in Kampala,
yeah,
very, very different.
In Kampala, there was what do you want? You can have everything that you want.
Yeah.
And I know we had all of that.
Yeah.
And I know that when we arrived here, how we grew up was totally different. It was a big flip from being very rich, well off, and you can do whatever you want, to the opposite side where, you know, my dad used to often say, he says, well, when I was working in that office, I would arrive at the train station and decide to do a 40-minute walk because it would save me 2p on the bus.
Okay.
So with that sense, he'd given me that sense.
Yeah.
How could I spend 0.5p on a packet of crisps or a bar of chocolate or whatever it was at that time? So I just wouldn't buy it.
Yeah.
And you know, they would go out at lunchtime to the fish and chips shop and buy some chips or something, you know? And I'd have my packed lunch from home.
Yeah.
Because we couldn't afford to have that money for that.
Exactly.
And even I remember this, you know, I was like in school and like I wanted to play a musical instrument and I could get something for free from the school and something where we need to buy something to have it at home to practice.
Okay.
I think it was a piano or an organ or something.
Okay.
You know, because you couldn't carry that backwards and forwards between schools.
No.
So they said, well, if you want to learn the piano, you've got to have one at home. So I remember coming and asking my dad, I'd like to learn to play the piano. And he said, I haven't got the money to do that. I'm really sorry.
Right.
So I played the flute.
Right.
Because I could carry that backwards and forward.
And actually, I think, Selimbhai, just in terms of everything you've mentioned there, that's very insightful in terms of your journey from Kampala getting here to the UK and also what life was like in the UK. But if I can take you back a little bit, because there's a couple of things I'd like to unpick and maybe get your views on what life was like through those experiences. I think it'll be quite helpful.
Yeah.
So first and foremost, when expulsion and that announcement was made in Kampala, What was that process of trying to get to the UK? Because I know for some people they had to arrange for visas, for example. Do you recall much about what that process was like for your family?
So what had happened was that my dad had a Ugandan passport.
Okay.
But my mum, from my Nana's side,
right,
had a British.
Okay.
So in those days, the three of us were able to travel on mum's passport, okay, as dependents.
Okay.
And I think it was a very, very minor formality. I don't think even you needed to go and register it. I'm not sure what the process was.
Right.
But we got out. They got out on the refugee thing, okay, you know, my dad and his family. And so, yeah, I think we didn't have that issue where I believe some people didn't know where they were going.
Right.
You know, and they ended up taking Norway, Sweden, some of them went to Canada, and some of them actually went back to India and Pakistan.
Right.
And in that sense, I believe possibly because of my two masis who were there and whatever, it sort of set the scene for the rest of our family that we're going to England.
Okay.
And in terms of that, I don't believe that was, but you see, I would have been removed from that decision because of my age,
right,
and the conversation around that.
Absolutely.
And also that, okay, maybe we'd arrived here and my dad would probably arrive here. What, yeah, decision his siblings made,
yeah,
and my grandfather made, I don't know what they did around the background. Maybe the fact that we were there, sort of, it made sense for them that,
yeah,
we'd all go there. Does that answer the question?
No, it does. It does. And in terms of, you know, everybody was given 90 days to exit the country, which, when you think about it, isn't a lot of time where you've got your whole life set up.
They could not bring anything along with them.
And that was it. How was that decision made, perhaps for your grandfathers, in terms of what do they bring? You know, how do you make that call? And I appreciate yourself and your siblings and your mother had been sent over here first, so you may not be able to recall, but
I
shared with you.
I do know the story, yeah, afterwards. So what my dad had done was he because he was a distributor, or should be a shop selling stuff. I don't know if you know what a tea chest is.
No.
It's a wooden box.
Okay.
It's almost like 2 foot by 2 foot by 2 foot.
Right.
But it's actually got plywood sides with metal ends.
Okay.
And then tea would come from, I presume, Ceylon at that time.
Yeah.
And we had all these tea chests. My dad had packed tea chests full of stuff.
Okay.
From Kabbalah.
Mm. What stuff?
Household items.
Right.
And he had packed them into these tea chests. And he had couriered them, or whatever the method was.
Okay.
You know, to UK. And I remember these boxes arriving after we got here by ship. But he did tell me that not all of them arrived.
Mm.
And we got some of the household items.
Okay.
Because obviously, when they came on the plane, they could hardly bring anything with them.
This is it.
In terms of personal positions, something I forgot was when we went, which was on the, I believe it was the 21st of August, we arrived here.
Okay.
Because, you know, you have to answer the question when you're taking out an insurance policy, like a car insurance. Were you born here? No. Mm. When did you come to this country?
Yeah.
Luckily, they don't ask the actual date, but on certain passport applications, they ask the date.
They do.
And it's 21st August, if I'm not mistaken. It's either 21st or 24th. I've got it written down somewhere.
Okay.
And I remember that we were going to the airport. And the other thing I forgot to mention was that they were told that the Ugandan, that you're not allowed even to take your jewellery with you. And apparently, some people had their jewellery confiscated from them, you know, at the airport and whatever. So I think what had happened was that us, as in the three young children, we'd actually got some necklaces of my mom's around our neck and whatever. And and my dad, because of his affinity to radios and all that, I remember this very clearly. We were leaving, and he's got this, I think it's a Hitachi radio.
Okay.
and it was sitting on the window shelf. And he's just got it off the shelf and he's giving it to me. He says, Alija Tarasate, take it with you.
Yeah.
He's giving me this radio. And I remember I'm carrying this Hitachi radio with my life, you know, to the airport. And then sort of, you know, I don't even know if they had overhead compartments at that time, but whatever, putting it somewhere. And then in Frankfurt, carrying it around with me and bringing it here and then carrying everywhere. And we had it for many years as well.
Wow. So to survive the journey across.
Yeah. So that, because that was obviously that for him in terms of.
It was important.
It was important and probably it was valuable.
Yeah.
Probably, you know, it's like, maybe like an iPad, it's worth a few, you know, worth of all the possessions that you had, it was something that.
Stood out.
Yeah, it stood out and it had value. It was electronic items, you know, there weren't many electronic items in that time.
Mm.
So yeah, we came with that. And then the other thing was, in these tea chests, I don't know why, he knew this before, he had put Ugandan shillings in.
Mm.
So he'd be opening up the boxes and in the sort of little compartment in there, bring out these Ugandan shillings. And then he'd known after he got here, they're worth nothing anyway.
Right.
So he used to say, well, waste of time, all of this.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, that was the experience regarding bringing the goods across.
Mm. And, well, did you have much of an understanding of what the UK was like when you were in Gambala? Did you, you know, was there any information about life in England or what to expect perhaps?
No, I don't. I would say we didn't have any expectation other than the two masses were there, and I didn't have any sort of conversation with them because I think at the age of six it's a very limited conversation.
Mm.
I was six turning seven.
Mm.
I do remember the sort of Kampala scenery as being very. Very sunny, and I remember you come here and it's very dreary because we arrived. Okay, August wasn't so bad, but soon September and October came along and it started getting dreary and cold.
Yeah.
So there was this sort of like weather interpretation. There was this that we were told before we went, and you know, when the decision was made, oh, you're going to a modern city. And it's like advanced and they've got so many things there, like, you know, traffic lights and, you know, escalators and all sorts of things that you didn't have in Kampala in Africa.
Mm.
So there was this sort of like expectation. All right. Yeah, fair enough. It's something bad that's happened to us.
Yeah.
But we're going to a modern place.
Okay.
Right. We're going to a more advanced country with, you know, better infrastructure. Not that a word was used, but it was a better place. Yeah. Is the perception that you had?
Do you think that helped give you maybe a sense of, I don't know if you can call it in such a way, but maybe hope or positivity?
Positivity, a bit of strength. Yeah.
About this change, exactly. You know, to get you through.
It was a consolation.
Yeah.
Okay, we're leaving Africa.
Yeah.
You know, and we're coming here. But I do hear, you know, my mom, because if I was to talk about their two post-departure experience, my dad was very bitter about the whole affair that he had to go through.
Yeah.
To the point he never wanted to go back.
Okay.
He said, no, I'm never setting foot there again.
Mm.
And he hasn't. I think now he would, although his health probably doesn't permit it.
Mm.
My mom has been back many times and she often talked about fond memories, and if she was given the option to go back, she would have gone back.
Right. That's very interesting.
And so she was somewhat more forgiving of the expulsion because she said it was paradise. You know, they call Uganda the Pearl of Africa.
Yeah.
And she remembers from her perspective that everything was so fresh and beautiful and, you know, so she connected with that sort of natural aspect.
Yeah.
And the food aspect was what she normally really connected with.
Yeah.
How the fruits were so, you know, the tropical fruits that we enjoyed over there, which we couldn't
get here
in no way. You probably wouldn't even be able to see those things. today you can go add anything and everything. But she would even still comment that it doesn't still have the same taste.
No. Yeah.
And my father often used to say that. I mean, you know, when we came here, because we eat meat, he says, he tried chicken and he said, and he wouldn't eat chicken for 2 years.
Yeah.
He said, this isn't the same as what I was used to over there.
Mm.
So there were those sort of like food sort of things which bring up memories. But your question was this expectation of what you had here. I think from my personal perspective, and my youngest sibling didn't have this same experience.
Okay.
Because she was only 2.5.
Right.
Is that this modernity and all that I knew about, and I related to it, she wouldn't have. But the experience of this feeling unwelcome and the racism that we suffered, which wasn't, I think some people suffered a lot of physical harm.
Okay.
I think mine was more verbal and intimidatory.
Right.
I don't think I suffered anything physical. Maybe something very minor.
Right.
But nothing major.
Mm.
It left a big scar for me, and left a big impression. Whereas my younger sibling, she said, "No, I didn't see any of that. None of that." So.
And maybe she benefited from being younger, perhaps, and maybe her experience was therefore different to maybe what you had encountered. Would you say that would be a fair summarization of it?
Yeah, I mean, if I was to ask my children today, have they experienced it? Well, the ethnic structure here is there's probably 85% Indians in the school that she goes to, even though it's a regular school. And even the private schools, you know, they even have the same ratio in this area where we live. But that's now.
Mm.
But you go back.
In the 70s, when you first arrived.
It wasn't like that.
Very different.
Very, very different.
Yeah.
I think that my younger sibling, myself and my brother, you know, who's just a year younger than me, we really felt it.
Okay.
We really felt it. If I look at my other cousins and all that, and they also experienced it,
right,
in the other places. So that sort of it touched me a lot. I know that much. So that was one of those sort of things, and I never really identified with British. Whereas if I ask my children, they're British and they're happy to be British. I was almost like, I had this sort of sense because of my experience.
Yeah.
And I didn't have this sense at all in Uganda. It wasn't something that was inside of me.
Mm.
But like, I definitely wouldn't be supporting England on a cricket match or a rugby or a football or whatever. You know?
Yeah.
And that was all born out of those experiences.
Yeah.
Those early experiences.
And actually, you've touched on something that I was going to come on to. And, you know, I'll take your lead on how comfortable you feel with answering this. But do you have a sense of belonging? And I say that in terms of the journey you've had to maybe get here. And now, obviously, London is where you've set up and this is where your family are and where you are. Where would you say you connect with the most? You know, do you have an affinity to Uganda still and Kampala? I appreciate you were still very young at the time everything happened and probably didn't get to live, spend as much time there as maybe your family would have hoped to have had. But what are your views?
So if I say to you, for me, emigration from this country is a possibility, but my primary driver today would be weather.
Okay.
It was to have a more warmer climb than the climb that we have here. Although the winters are much milder than when we arrived in the 70s.
Yeah.
We've had a bit of a colder winter this year than most.
Yeah.
But I think what's happened is that the ethnicity in the areas that we live in and my interactions with the native English here have changed my perception.
Okay.
Because if I say to you that, so in say 10 years after I got here and I had applied for a pre-university sponsorship, which I got, but I remember that I'd sent out so many applications that I'm guessing that many were just rejected based on the name on the application.
Okay.
Many were told that, you know, your application should just be thrown in the bin because they had experience of it because of your name.
Right.
To the point where when my oldest daughter was born, we chose a name for her, which wouldn't identify her from her first name. Mm. We called her Maria.
Okay.
We call her Maria, but it's Maria. That's how we spell it. Mm. And a lot of my other friends did the same thing. They picked names like Adam for boys. Names that would not be connotation.
Yeah.
And that was all due to this sort of racism. So I remember going for this sponsorship interview at, it was in Cheltenham, so it was for some sort of defense company. Mm. And I saw racism in my face there, and that was as a 17-year-old. Mm. I saw it stare me in the face. Where I went through the interviews and passed with flying colors because they do aptitude tests before you get to an interview.
Okay.
You know, it's almost like, and I was good at school because my parents had told me, you need to do this, right? And so I would do it very, very hard to do well. Mm-hmm. And I was good at what I did. So these tests, they weren't a problem. Mm. So, but I remember going to the interview and I said to the guy, he says, oh, so what's your aspirations? I said, well, I'd rather go into management.
Right.
And, it was very much a blue collar, white collar. And the blue collar was dark.
Yeah.
And the white collar was white. Mm. That's exactly how it was. And then, and he said, if you want a job in management, go and work in Sainsbury's. That's what he said to me. Mm. But I wanted to go into engineering. And on the flip side, I got a job at Jaguar as a sponsorship, because the Commission for Racial Equality had been in there for 3 years, done an investigation saying how comes the shop floor is 90% dark, and the white collar is 99% white, and so they were told you need to, and so I actually positive discrimination got me into that job.
Okay.
My merit, which I'm sure I had,
didn't
count for anything. So these are the challenges, and mm-hmm. and you'll find, you know, you'll find that you go into a shop and you won't get served.
Yeah.
You know, and it was even by the Indians wouldn't serve you.
Right.
The Indians would serve a white-faced person. It's okay. Just the way it was. They made comedy programs in the 70s about that.
Yeah.
And people make comedy about that today as well, you know, stand-up comedians. So that was very much the sort of culture that we're in. You know?
And maybe a final point, and feel free to share anything else as well. It's very interesting that you mentioned that both your mother and father have a very different view of Uganda after their experiences. I think, obviously, for your father, for him, the situation is very different to what he left it in, and I think it's a difficult time to process, you know, what's happened to you, whereas your mum's obviously been back and visited. What about for yourself? Have you been back to Uganda?
Yeah, I went back because my dad, my mum's side of the family, they had property, and I went back in 91.
Yeah.
And to be honest, you said to me, you know, how do you feel at home about this country? Uganda was on my list, on my top list. I want to go back to Uganda.
Okay.
Right? But unfortunately, the whole thing was vetoed. You know? No way am I going to Africa. But you haven't even been to Africa to know what it's like. No, I'm not going there. Should we go and have a look? No!
After we were out, then you
have. You can tell me after.
So I wouldn't mind going there because, you see, in terms of my own life journey, independent of the Exodus experience, I would much rather live a life in a natural environment than in an artificial environment. We find ourselves in artificial environments here.
Yeah.
So that was my motivation, my driver. I would equally go to a place in India.
Okay.
But I think what had happened was because these early migrants, my grandfathers, had left. My mum's side of the family, they're quite connected. My dad's side of the family, they'd welcome us if he went there.
Yeah.
So I didn't tell you what the reason why my dad's father left Jamnagar.
Mm.
It was a very simple story. His father had a shop, and he had three brothers.
Mm.
And the three brothers were going to inherit the shop. The two sisters were going to get married and go wherever their journey took them.
Mm.
And one of the brothers, my dad's kaka, he had nine kids, and my grandfather wasn't even married there. He said, right, this shop will not support the nine kids that, yes, this man has had, nine boys.
Yeah.
Forget about it, even if I don't have any kids, it's not going to support me.
Yeah.
And so that was his reason for going there. But when he went, he hardly went back.
Okay.
So there's no connection with the motherland, as it were.
Okay.
And it was severed.
Right.
And so when my dad actually went back to India, he was 50.
Right.
So it was a big gap. And although they all welcomed him, there was no sort of ongoing connection, and he felt different. And I think maybe if you went back there and you wanted to sort of stay there for 6 months, you might be able to rekindle those relationships and feel comfortable.
Mm.
So in answer to what is home and where are your roots? Well, now, if I had made the move out of this country because I wasn't happy when my kids were younger, they wouldn't have had a choice.
Yeah.
If I tried to ask them today, none of them are going to leave this country because they see
this is their home.
This is their home.
Yeah.
And so from that sense, the feeling of not being at home, not feeling at home, the racism that I experienced here, although it's melted, I still see it. I can spot it a mile off when it's prevalent.
Mm.
And I don't know if you spotted it in the law field today. I'm sure it's rife there.
Yeah.
I'm sure it is.
Yeah.
But it doesn't... Depends where you're at, you know, in the corporate ladder. In the time that we grew up, you'd have to become very anglicized.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I tell you why I didn't stay with Jaguar. Because I noticed early on, I mean, I don't drink or smoke for my religious beliefs.
Mm.
And while I was a student, graduate, trainee within their graduate training program in Coventry, and I lived there for 3 years, and I had a guaranteed job with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it was exactly engineering management is what they'd recruited me for. Recruitment opportunities were determined by a Friday pub.
Right.
And the bosses would be there, and you'd have to rub shoulders with them. And I just didn't go because I didn't want to drink. I just didn't want to be in that environment. So when you talk about, it wasn't home for me, even from a religious ideology perspective. Mm. I didn't want to do what I was required to do to succeed in that environment.
Mm.
And there was this phrase that went... on about those people who did what they needed to do, and they were called I can't remember whether it was coconuts, but it was the reverse. They were white on the outside and brown on the inside rather than what they actually were.
Okay.
And they had to compromise their own identity and their own values to actually to do well in those settings.
Okay.
And you find those that went into the corporate world in the 70s.
Yeah.
They had to do a lot of that.
Yeah.
And so it depends who you were and where you were and whether you wanted to do all of that to determine what was home. But it wasn't a comfortable place to call your home.
Yeah.
That was my experience. Okay, today I'm sort of detached from all of it because I ran my own business, so I didn't have to be answerable to anybody. You know, I never had to sort of please a boss or whatever. I've never had to do that in all my working life.
Yeah.
So I've been my own person, so I haven't been affected by that. And I chose to do that for that reason.
Yeah.
I'm not going to, you know, have to suck up to somebody or do whatever I need to do wherever. So I didn't have that experience, but had I not... then I probably wouldn't feel comfortable here because you whether it was happening or not, you'd always feel, it's because of the color of my skin that I'm not doing well here.
Mm.
And it was a definite reality then, and I felt it even in very limited capacities, like interviews at, you know, felt it.
Yeah.
So that aspect. And you know, I see people, because there was two aspects to reading people. So you learn to read people, and you wanted to decide very early on, and first impression's best impression, I always say that.
Yeah.
Because you can be persuaded otherwise by when they open their mouth and then they start saying things which you think, okay, it's not a bad person. But the first impression's the best impression, usually, because it's come from the heart.
Yeah.
And I can still see it today, that element of racism exists.
Yeah.
Prejudice. And that would be the only aspect of this country,
yeah,
which, you know, in the circles I mix in now, I don't come across it.
Yeah.
In fact, even at school, if there was a pure English person,
yeah,
they would have to mold to the rest of the consensus of that group.
Right.
They wouldn't be able to survive. They'd have to, like, move out of the country and, you know, go into their circles if they wanted to be snotty about somebody of another colour.
Yeah. No, that's very interesting. So anyway, I think that covers everything that I wanted to know from you, and I'm very grateful to you for sharing your experiences. Was there anything else that you would like to mention, or...?
I can't think at the moment.
That's okay. No?
Well, let's try, and then if I think of something, we can put that back on.
Thank you.
Yeah, I should say that. Yeah, look, the country has served us well. I mean, there is this this scenario where a lot of the elders in the family talk about the rich became poor and the poor became rich.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've heard that. So the experience amongst certain families was they were not doing well.
Yeah.
But as soon as they arrived here, they had... you know, say 6 kids or 8 kids, well, all of them could get a job, and they were still living in one house. So suddenly they surplus money much quicker than what we ended up doing, where we were split into 3 families. We were one family back in Africa. And had we been able to survive in one unit, right, we would have done that. So there was that flipping. But the thing is, as a journey, even a migratory journey, and I look at, well, what did my grandfather do by leaving Africa? So I'll just share with my experience, because I went to India 3 years after my dad's first visit at the age of 50. He took us, we went again.
Yeah.
And I remember going to Jamnagar specifically.
Mm.
And I arrived in Jamnagar, and I'm looking at my dad's cousins, you know, my grandfather's brothers' families, and I was thinking, oh, I'm so glad my grandfather decided to leave Jamnagar in the late 80s and come to Africa, and then from there we got to England, and we're doing so much better than this lot over there, because there's a place in Jamnagar called Furries, the local areas, and we used to come from Bawa Furry.
Okay.
And it was really backward, you know, even in the 80s. I haven't been to Jamnagar, but it's there on my next trip. I mean, I go to India regularly, but it just tends to be Bombay.
Yeah.
Because my wife's family is from Bombay. I want to go back to Jamnagar because from what I understand, if I look at a 100-year migratory cycle, India's the place to be tomorrow, I believe.
Yeah.
So whether my children recognize that or not, in terms of cycle of migration, for my grandfathers in the early 1900s, outside India was the right place to be.
Yeah.
But I believe that there will be a shift in wealth from west to east, and possibly opportunities, maybe. Although the population in India is big, and if they all step up, then it may not be so easy to succeed in that environment because they're far more competitive than we would be. And the culture is different, you know, the business culture and everything, you know. But from a quality of life point of view, it might be. So it's very interesting because I've looked at that 100-year migration cycle. Mm. But England has served us well because, you know, the thing about England is they gave us a roof. We didn't sleep on the streets.
Yeah.
I mean, I hear friends of mine who come from Iraq and Iran, and you know, you hear them sleeping out in parks in 2 or 3 days. We didn't have to do any of that.
Mm.
We had roof, food, money, education, health. We had all of that.
Mm.
So for that reason, we have to be grateful for that, for the opportunities that we had here. And when you listen to some of the other experiences of some of the other people who went to India and they had a really hard time, Pakistan, and then they ended up back here. So I think, yes, on the whole, if we look back on it retrospectively, it's been good. But it did set us back.
Yeah.
You know, in my dad's case, it set him back a minimum of 10 years.
Mm.
And I think his and mum's stories, why they're so different, is that he felt his whole world and the way, whatever his hard work was all just taken away from him.
Mm.
That's why he has bitterness towards his time in Uganda.
Mm.
And mom has chosen not to focus on that.
Yeah.
And remember the better times that they've had there. And I know that there were many who arrived who did pass away early because they couldn't reconcile them being here and they contracted illnesses or whatever description. And
it was
they
a big
passed.
Shift in every which way, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the displacement.
Mm.
Being younger, I don't think we felt the brunt of it.
Okay.
You know, I mean, because, yeah, we didn't feel the brunt of it. But I do believe, because I've shared the history, and I haven't sort of put it to one side and left it, I've tried to ask them, how did you feel? And it's sort of still alive.
Yeah.
Me, I can recollect what they all went through.
Right.
All the other elders.
Mm.
Not that I experienced the same thing myself.
Yeah. But you can relate to their...
I can relate to it and I recognize it as being alive today.
Yeah.
As opposed to something of the past which
that
is forgotten about. Yeah.
Way back when.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.